Antidote for night. So much as close my eyes, and a flayed Labrador is laid at my doorstep. And here's the same bone lodged in the slippery pottage of my heart, where this man croons, "Baby, you're so sweet," until I take his head between my hands and lay it on my breast. There's the moon in the high window, her wall eye glancing off me, and a few bobbing stars, every tawdry shining thing. I've identified Venus more times than I can count as an agent for insomnia, a broad sail that catches the wind and slides away. Not even halfway through the hours, his fitful sleep, wheeze of a saber saw, waves receding on a rocky shore, breath whip-snaking down a chute until his body forgets. How still, how close the kingdom, one stalled gulp away. And I jostle his dying shoulder. He recoils, yes, rebels, back now, mouth full of silver. "What?" he moans to darkness. "What?"
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, welcome to Poets Cafe. Marcia de la O is the author of Antidote for Night, which recently won the Isabella Gardner Award, published by BOA Editions. Her first book, Black Hope, won the New Issues Press Poetry Prize from the University of Western Michigan. She is the winner of the 2014 Morton Marcus Poetry Award, as well as the DA Poetry Award and the Ventura Poetry Festival Contest. Her work has been published in Miramar, The New Yorker, and other fine publications, and anthologized in several collections, including Intimate Nature, The Bond Between Women and Animals. She was raised in the Los Angeles area and now lives in Ventura, California, where she is co-editor for the literary journal Spillway. So, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you're finally here. An antidote is a remedy. It's a solution, right, for some kind of, if we can take it as a medicine. It can be a counter to a poison. And it seems, though, in your art that you take on kind of both the poison and the remedy. Because even in this dark blooming of your poems, I love it. There's a luminescence which is really larger than the night. And here, when the man in this poem with his mouth of silver awakens, he's traveled really in that hinterland beyond the body. For me, it's this darkness is highly ecstatic. So you kind of combine this, which is beautiful to me. You said in an interview elsewhere that you believe any poet writes what he or she has been given, and I've been thinking about that a lot. I feel sort of an obligation on the one hand to write poems that are uplifting, and then on the other side I'm drawn to this dark side, and I wonder if you've thought about that element further, and do you continue to draw from that well?
I continue to draw from that well.
Okay.
And in terms of that, the obligation to be uplifting, I have no such obligation, I think, although one of the poems I'm going to read in this interview does have to do with the obligation to be uplifting. I accepted that as a challenge. As for what you said about poison and remedy, well, they do go together, don't they? Mm-hmm. I mean, an antidote is a direct response to perhaps a poison or an illness.
Right. And I think for me, that combination together takes it out of a place which could leave us without any hope or without any sense of nourishment or, do you know what I mean? Because there's an aesthetic nourishment, even in the dark ecstatic, that luminosity is there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, and I'm really glad to hear you say that because I'm always in this space of, well, this is, you know, this poem is dark. Like, I feel like I have to justify it or something, you know. Oh, I love that poem you wrote. It's very dark, but, you know, whatever. But it's good to hear that you keep drawing from that well and encouraging, because you have taken that path and proven with your, you know, the acknowledgement that's been given to your work, and even especially in recent years, the New Yorker publishing that fantastic poem. It's really good to know that you're on that, on the right path for you.
Yeah, I think we have permission for any path.
You think so?
Yeah. In poetry, yes.
Okay.
Why wouldn't a person feel open to whatever path their imagination opens to them?
Because I think, I don't know, I have pressure from different people. Oh, you know, you should be filling the world with light, and the world needs all of that, and what will we do? And I'm like, okay, there are poets that do that. And then there are poets that speak to whatever is in them that they want to share. And some of those places, as in your book, we have to go to speak about them, to have the freedom to talk about them.
Well, in that particular poem, Antidote for Night, that I just read, if you think about it, well, what's that about, really? I mean, there's a section that's about sleep apnea.
Right.
There's a section
that's the best sleep apnea poem ever.
It's about how close we are to death. Mm-hmm. There's a section that's about sort of the clumsy, imperfect love between two people. There's a section that's about sort of waking up at night, insomnia. But it opens with basically nightmare. Mm-hmm. It opens with nightmare, and that first image is the image of a flayed dog, a right. flayed Labrador. And that, I will admit that when I first dreamed that, I woke up, and when I wrote the poem, I didn't exactly know what that flayed Labrador meant to me. And I was initially horrified. I was horrified sure. that I had to dream that. So if you think about what that meant for me, well, you wake up, wake up, wake up. Are you having a nightmare? Wake up. But it's not about that it's horrifying for me to dream it. Ultimately, what it's about for me is the larger meaning is it was laid on my doorstep, right? I opened the door, and there it was.
Right.
So what the flayed dog to me is the suffering in the world that's not seen. Mm. It's not seen. It's not my burden. It's where do I want to stand in relationship to the suffering in the world. And I'm someone who's always had nightmares. I've always had nightmares. So this nightmare comes to me, and what is nightmare asking of me at this point in my life? And what does it want from me? And what does it want from me? It wants me to get past my fear and my recoil and whatever else stops me, my sure. self-loathing, and be able to stand in relationship to the kind of suffering that was in that image.
Mm.
So that's a good thing for me. That's like super positive.
Absolutely. Speaking of our world, there's another poem I'd love to hear you read called Murmur.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd love to read that one.
Okay.
And I just want to say, relative to Murmur, before I read it, that
sure.
this particular poem is, in fact, the poem that I wrote sort of in as an obligation to be positive. I knew a woman who was working on, she was working on like a play for voices about the goddess Inanna and her descent into the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
She did come back up. So she wanted some voices of ascent, and she challenged me to write one. And so I'm very grateful. I was very grateful for the challenge, because I wrote Murmur.
It's a beauty. Let's hear it.
Murmur. Right now, it's simple. Agua de tamarindo. A marmalade cat straggling across the street at twilight, her solemn eyes on me. Ditching dinner for melted cabot cheddar on seed bread. hunks of papaya, rose-tinged flesh mounded in a blue glass bowl. Black coffee with a bitter undertow. The world has not stopped speaking. All manner of things murmur. Nothing here means you harm. The way elliptical shapes of light fall at just the right angle between beams of the Ramada. Moving shadows the wind guides through this mottled world. Cloud shadow feathering my shoulders, leaf patterns stirring, and just like that, the wind leaves me whole. Easy to say yes to the monsoon sliding up from Mexico in a musky velvet gown. Gracias to the small rivers of air off the ocean that flow up dry creek beds every afternoon. It all comes down to air, to the bargain a stranger made a long time ago with a dying girl when he turned her head and cleared the passage so she could breathe fully the accident of happiness. Billows of air taken in, given back, and it's a snap, breathing like a champ, like I loved my own lost self all along.
Beautiful. Oh, gosh. And it feels so appropriate now, just for the moment of our earth and everything that's going on. It's just, for me as a reader, it has this deep elemental sense in us. It's like a world breath for me, like Gaia breathing. And
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, how sensitive we are to that. And there's a lot of breath in Antidote for Night, I noticed. David St. John said that you take over the reader's breath when you write a poem. And I was thinking about how you do that, because your work has a sort of incantational aspect to it. It's very chanting kind of rhythm, and there's a lot of breath involved. Even when I read the poems out loud, what do you think about, what does breath mean to you? And do you, is it a conscious thought when you're writing, or?
I don't think so, but for me to have a serious relationship with any poem by any writer, if I want to be close to it deeply,
yeah,
I read it out loud. I put it into my breath. And sometimes that's a big cost because, you know, to read out loud poem after poem. But
yeah,
it's not intimate and it's not real until it passes through my body.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And that's how I felt when I was reading your poems. It's one thing to have it on the page. It's another thing to hear you read it, and then to take it in yourself and to read it, because then that breath becomes you, and also the music of the poet, which you have an extraordinary amount of them. And we'll speak to that in another of your poems. What poets have you been drawn to in your history of writing and reading?
Early, I was very, very drawn to Lorca.
Yeah.
And
I said, yeah, because I can feel it. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
And then one of the very first, maybe it was the very first poet that I heard read live was Octavio Paz. And he came to my college, and so I was kind of interested in Spanish poetry anyway, and there was this great figure who dealt very strongly with elementals, you know, with stone and light, and so it was shocking and gorgeous and transporting, and it was the very first time I had that experience. I felt afterwards I had to walk outside and stand there in the dark, you know, on the auditorium's steps outside, and he felt the same way. So there he was, just a few steps away from me. He was a very large man, and I was like down, and I thought,
Marcia's very petite.
I could go over there and I can say, muy bonito, you know. Muy, muy bonito. But I didn't quite dare. And then all the Spanish-speaking kind of intelligentsia of Los Angeles had come to that. Wow. And they came rushing out and surrounded him. And, of course, I wasn't going to make my way through or anything. But so right there, it was a whole different world that I saw right in front of me.
Yeah.
So that was a big influence. And then after that, after college, I worked briefly at the Huntington Library. Mm-hmm. And the Virginia Woolf Scholar came out and she said, I have a cousin from, I don't remember if he was from Tennessee or North Carolina. I have a cousin coming, and I don't know if anyone will come. He's giving a reading here. His name is Charles Wright. And so this was early Charles Wright.
Right.
Early Charles Wright. And so I admired her very much, the Virginia Woolf Scholar. And I said, well, I certainly will be there. So it was like my second poetry reading. And I was right up in front with determined to be in a very intense relationship with the poet, because I was going to personally protect him from the Junior League, mm-hmm. whom I did not imagine listened very well. And so I did. I was. And his accessibility was a revelation mm-hmm. for me. He was, at that time, working a lot with the death of one of his parents, I believe. And I mean, this was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And how clear it came to me. His poetic voice came through mm-hmm. in those beautiful, longer poems. And I was like, oh, Charles Wright is my favorite poem, everyone.
That's fantastic. It actually brings up an interesting question, because some of your poems are narrative and some have elliptical, they're mysterious poems. And I love that, because as a reader, I want to participate with what's going on there and use my own thoughts, imagination, spirit with the poem. If you just tuned in, this is host Lois P. Jones, and we're here with our guest, Marcia De La O, on Poets Cafe. How do you know when a poem is visible to the reader?
Oh, I don't necessarily know, but I do.
That's an honest answer, because I don't know either. Go ahead. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, though, because I've been thinking about it.
I read them. I belong to a poetry community in Ventura, and and they have an open mic, and so I go every week if I can, and I always read them, and sometimes, you know, more than one separated by time, and I always revise based on energy, like energy that comes back at me mm-hmm. from the group,
mm-hmm.
and the group is a seriously attentive group,
That's
a seriously
great.
Responsive group, so the energy that comes back is a good gauge of what they've done with it, whatever they've done with it, and I don't mean whether or not they've understood it necessarily. And then I also belong to smaller workshop groups where there's more explicit look and I get more explicit information about how specifically it's understood.
Mm-hmm.
But that energy gauge is actually an important one for me.
That's good. That's good to know. I know some of our listeners out there, poets in particular, but writers certainly of any genre, may have that question, because we tend to sometimes be in a sort of insular and in a vacuum and then gravitate toward groups. I go back and forth. I think a lot of it depends on the group, and if you feel good and comfortable and you're really getting what you need from that group, then, you know, mm-hmm. both people or participants are growing from that experience.
And I think the great knowledge from any group is how individual and personal and constructive any reader's take is on any poem, how contributory they are.
Okay. And I know, because I was in one sort of workshop experience with you, not the one you gave, but one that someone else was giving, and I was really impressed by the way you just take it all in professionally. You know, I think that, well, I mean that writers can tend to get jostled sometimes by different things that people say, and having that kind of equilibrium where you can use what comes in from people and but not let it sort of alter you from what you know about the poem, I think.
I write everything down that anyone says.
Do you?
Yes, I write everything down, and I do let it alter me, and then oftentimes I try what people say, and then I let it sink, and then I read it out loud, and then I decide.
How about if we head to another poem? I think we're having a little less time than I thought we would. Could we hop to something fresh?
Oh, sure. This is a poem for my husband, and he's had a bad health summer, so it's a real pleasure to read this poem. Mm-hmm. Speaking of response groups, I belong to one response group where people take it upon themselves to very briefly offer just a few words just at the end that might be a writing prompt for the next. And we are under absolutely no obligation to follow that prompt. So one time the wonderful Santa Barbara Buddhist poet, Barry Spax, decided to offer the prompt, and he said, "I'd like us to write something fresh about a bird." You know, not something romantic. I mean, there's nothing more tired and hackneyed than poems on birds and poets. And so I was thinking I was going to ignore it, and then very close to the time I was going to go back, I thought, oh, wait a minute, I can do this.
I got it.
So it's called Something Fresh. Something fresh. This is my chance to untangle the riddle. He's a bramble, an enigma, a dew-eyed ramble, mouth full of quips, both the bird and the bush, brother and briar, a metabolic frolic, an off-kilter wallop, able to pound out, scratch out, peck out. He's no tabula rasa. He's written up, written off into thousands of sunsets, black and white and red all over. He's the noisiest quiet you'll ever want to know. My big yes, my full court press, chari, a skinflint with lexicon but rash on syntax. No warrior, yet nature built him compact. The better to swing a battle axe, he told me that on our second date. A stray molecule yearning to burn in the bonds of delight. He's my snake bit baby, my history of the blues, my personal fuse box, my litmus test, my witness, a stroll in a dog park. No saint, but yeah, the guy is something fresh about a bird.
I love that. Oh, God, that is so good. It almost has a spoken word sort of feel to it, you know, like you could memorize this and get out there and just totally do it.
Yeah, it kind of unrolls, doesn't it? And I'd love to read it when he's there because he blushes.
Oh, I know, these lines are amazing. They're just so great. And you could feel that, for me as a reader, it feels absolutely non-contrived. You know, it's just right there, and it came out, and these playful rhythms and rhymes in there. And written off thousands of sunsets, the noisiest quiet you'll ever want to know. I know people like that. Yeah, that's great. Oh, love it. That's the music that inhabits you. And it's a part of this fantastic book for our listeners, Antidote for Night on BOA Editions. It's an award-winning book. You will love every poem here. It's so moving. There's something that is for the love of poets who are looking for the underlying metaphor, great language and intelligence, and for all of our listeners who it's not necessarily for people that are poets, because I think it's all very accessible. I was very surprised to find, actually, Marcia, that, I don't know if you know this or not, there are people that have recited poems of yours on the internet and videos. There's the lemon tree one. I found like three kids. They had sat there with your poem and they were reading the lemon tree aloud.
Oh, really? That might be, if they were high school kids.
Yeah.
It's because they have a wonderful sort of recitation contest.
Okay. That
was started by, actually by Dana Gioia when he was the head.
Okay.
And it's called Poetry Out Loud.
And so that
and
poem,
that poem happens to be included, and I'm so honored.
Yeah.
I'm so honored.
It's fantastic. Well, you're on YouTube all over. I think we're running out of time, actually. Can we get in that last poem once? Let's take us out with once.
Okay. Once, that old train whistle wakes me at midnight, tracks hardly used now. Just a spur to the warehouse where they heap the cars with lemons bound for Asia. Another lone cry at one, and the train rumbles off to the port. Once, a mockingbird perched in the umbrella tree woke me. Song like dark honey, like the rain we yearn for. A cistern in my heart, full as never again.
Thank you for coming on the show, Marcia. That was beautiful.
Thank you for having me.
This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Marcia De La O. Thanks to our master chef, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. ¶¶